Unfortunately, those people speak with a very loud voice when it comes to American policy.
Well, I think they're going to end up with the Senate coming up this fall, and they already have the House, pretty
right.
much.
What this means is that the chances of us continuing to do nothing are very good at this point.
Huh.
This is a bad problem, and we're going to dig into more of the specifics of this report as we go through the program. However, I mentioned that this is a global problem.
Yes.
This is a threat to people everywhere, to food security, to food production. This threatens low-lying coastal regions all around the world, most of which are populated by people a whole lot worse off materially than the developed world is.
Except New York.
Except for New York and Florida.
And Baltimore.
You're right. Right.
Maybe San Diego.
This raises the specter of increased political and military tensions as nations squabble over diminishing resources.
Well, that's good. We can use up all those weapons we've wasted a fortune on.
Right, right. This is going to exacerbate existing health problems around the world. This is a really bad, bad state of affairs.
Well, maybe we'll evolve gills.
Maybe we will. Are you aware of evolutionary time frames?
No.
Okay, you're not going to evolve gills in your lifetime.
Oh, no?
Or my lifetime.
Oh.
Or 1,000 generations from now. You're not going to evolve gills.
Well, how about skin between your
Webbing?
Finger. Webbing. Yes,
no.
Webbing.
No.
No, no, no
okay.
Webbing.
I'm going to have to explain to you how natural selection works.
Why don't you work on that?
All right. So I'm going to run down quickly the major ways in which global climate change is going to affect all of us. And then we're going to relate this global phenomenon to a couple of local issues.
Yes.
Because really, like no other case before in history, what's global is local when it comes to climate change. Okay. First of all, the global economy is going to take a hit. According to the Independent of London, the estimated range of global income loss from the temperature rise of about 2 degrees centigrade is between 0.2 and 2%. But most estimates indicate that it's going to be toward the high end of this range, if not beyond the high end of this range. Now, this may sound like wonkish number crunching, but I guarantee you that a 2% global economic slowdown is going to be bad, and mostly bad for people who don't have a whole lot to begin with.
Well, that's okay. Poor people.
Right.
We don't care.
Further, the climate extremes put health and lives at risk. The report highlights the threats posed by natural disasters and overall changes to the environment. We're talking about more incidences of extreme climate-related weather. Heat waves, droughts, floods, cyclones, wildfires, and on and on and on. The impacts of such climate-related extremes include alteration of ecosystems, disruption of food production and water supply, damage to infrastructure and settlements, increased morbidity and mortality, and consequences for overall for mental health and human well-being. Of course, this is all, as we mentioned before, much worse for people in less developed, poorer nations.
Like California.
Right, indeed. According to Climate Progress, an increase in conflict and violence threatens global security. According to Modern Farmer, the quantity and quality of food will be affected. Modern Farmer writes, if you are a 21st century farmer, here's where you want to be. Somewhere cool with some cushy crop insurance and a government that is willing and able to help out. Otherwise, you're in big trouble. Traditional farming methods in many regions of the world will simply not be viable anymore because places which used to receive enough seasonal rainfall won't. Places that used to receive an adequate amount of seasonal rainfall may receive much more than they're used to seeing. And there's increasing areas of the globe in which a phenomenon called desertification is happening. And we'll talk a little bit more about
that. Like the Salal? We're going to talk about the Salal.
Right, indeed. Where desert regions are growing and wooded regions are receding.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the threats not only to human life but to wildlife in the broader ecosystem are legion. When I mentioned earlier that we are changing the conditions that led to our own evolution, that of course is a very anthropocentric viewpoint. We're also threatening the conditions that led to everything else's evolution. We're tinkering with things we ought not to tinker with.
Well, the ice bears disappear. I think we call them polar bears in this country. Polar
bears
are going away.
So that's what's happening on a global scale. How is this impacting us here in the Portland area, Joe?
Yeah, really. Well, here's a couple of simple examples. The first example I have is mundane, but nevertheless indicative. Apparently the city of Portland's forester, the city has a forester, and the person who'd had that job before was very sympathetic to large old trees in good old neighborhoods.
I mean, he would go give them hugs and console them?
We hug the trees. We're tree huggers. We hug the trees. We try to prune them, keep them healthy, because two reasons. They provide shade, which in turn reduces temperatures and produces more oxygen. Mm-hmm. That's number one.
And they're pretty.
Yeah, and they're pretty. And number two, it keeps property values high. There have been many studies that show that where there's old trees, given the housing stock being the same, compared to areas where there's no trees or small trees, the value of those properties is higher, which means if you happen to be lucky enough to be a property owner, you have an advantage in such neighborhoods. Now, one such neighborhood is Irvington. Mm-hmm. Irvington's it's a neighborhood that at one point had a large African-American population. Prices rose. Predictably, African-Americans as a community more or less disappeared from the neighborhood. Few still remain. However, as house value rose, one of the factors was the tree-lined streets. Mm-hmm. Now, the city sidewalk inspectors, together with the foresters, are doing a new thing. They're coming down these streets and they're declaring sidewalks to be cracked or bad or stub toes or whatever that need repair, which is fine. But in that process, they are discovering that root systems of large old trees interfere with those sidewalks. So what seems to be happening, as far as we can tell, and I'm going to be doing some statistical work to demonstrate this in the near future, is that as the sidewalk inspections take place, people who make sidewalks, small contractors, follow the path of those inspectors, and as the need for sidewalks gets pulled in the system, they then follow that, come to those householders and say, hey, I can put this sidewalk in for X number of dollars, and then they say, oh, look, your roots are in the way, the tree has to come down, but my partner here can cut your tree down for Y number of dollars.
Very cozy relationship.
Very cozy relationship. Very, very cozy.
So this is an example where local economic pressures are dictating actions that diminish property value, the beauty of our city, and exacerbate the problem of global warming.
Yes. It's a classic example on a very small scale, a micro scale.
Right.
And it's typical of what goes on, I think, all over the middle to upper class communities, unless they organize and fight these things, or if they're even aware of it. You know what goes on in your block, but you may not notice three blocks over. And this is something that has not been covered in the press, of course, but is clearly happening throughout the city. And, one of the sad facts around it is that the contractors, the concrete contractors, mostly are smaller firms. Mm-hmm. And so they're very motivated to get as much work as possible.
Sure. And which in and of itself is okay.
Yeah. And right. And often they also have relatives or friends or themselves are people who cut down trees. They're not, I want to be clear, they're not foresters, they're not tree surgeons, they're tree killers. So they come in, they cut down the big old trees, and then you can buy or get given a small tree that in 30 years will be a bigger tree, and maybe 100 years will be a nice tree.
That'll wreck your sidewalk.
That'll wreck your sidewalk again. It will go through the whole process again. So this is, this is just a small example of destroying the oxygen production system within the city itself.
Okay, so we've got that at a local level. And also the primary driver of the gradual increase of average global temperature is the combustion, of course, of fossil fuels.
Yes.
And we have another local example of the dangers of that practice.
Yeah, we know of an interesting event that is rather important, I think we have someone from Riverkeepers who can talk with us about this. I'm not sure.
Yeah, this is Dan Sears. I'm on the line.
Hi,
hey,
Dan.
Welcome.
Listen,
hey.
I
sorry about that clunky.
I called you yesterday because I saw a piece that you put online, something about a natural gas leak. What is this?
Yeah, so there's a facility out in Plymouth, Washington, which is kind of at the eastern end of the state. It's sort of where, if you're driving to the Tri-Cities, where you would cross the Columbia and head north towards Kennewick.
Ah.
So at that site, Williams Natural Gas Company, it's actually Williams Northwest is the name of the company.
Williams Northwest, yeah.
Williams Northwest, one of the biggest gas companies in North America, operates a facility that takes gas and super cools it down to liquefied natural gas.
Ah, LNG, I think.
LNG, exactly, which is obviously been in the news in other parts of the state. So what happened is there was an explosion at the facility.
Wait a minute. There was nothing on the news about the explosion? I didn't see anything on Channel 6, Channel 2, Channel 8.
I didn't see a huge fireball.
And I didn't hear it. There's nothing in the New York Times.
There was a huge fireball?
Yeah, there was.
There was a big fireball that went hundreds of feet into the air.
Whoa.
So,
but not covered. Not covered.
It was actually covered by Channel 2, and I know Channel 8 is covering it today.
Well, that's good.
Give some credit where it's due.
Okay.
But, essentially what happened is there was an explosion in one of the sort of smaller buildings, and it sent a piece of shrapnel into a very large storage tank of LNG.
Ah.
Which is not a good situation. And that prompted emergency responders to evacuate a two-mile radius around the facility. And it ended up injuring five workers who worked there. One of them was injured severely enough that he had to be sent to the burn center in Portland. Four others were able to be treated locally. Apparently, none of the injuries are expected to be fatal, but we don't have a clear update on the status of those four.
So let me get this straight. There was a failure in one building. It exploded. Shrapnel went and hit the tank, which is insulated, actually. And the consequence of that was to release a large amount of under pressure liquefied natural gas, which I guess what then formed a cloud.
Yeah. So the LNG is actually not under pressure.
I'm sorry.
What it is, it's kind of like a big thermos bottle. But once it's exposed to ambient air, of course, it's going to rewarm, and that vapor that came out was very cold enough that it would sort of freeze over the hole in the tank, and over time, the outside air would thaw through that hole, and then it would start releasing gas again.
So
it did this freeze-thaw cycle for hours, and they had to keep people evacuated in the area. Initially, it was almost 1,000 people who had to be moved out of the area. That number has gone down as the radius of risk has gone down. But it's just an incredibly jarring and alarming event. And it really highlights the risk that local communities face with these very large fossil fuel facilities. The other thing that is unmistakable is that methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas.
Indeed.
And so these sorts of events and the routine leakage of methane during the production of natural gas is something that's a very large concern to people who are watching the proposed expansion of LNG facilities in the Northwest.
Well, now there's plans to put pipes all the way across Oregon, across various states, to places like Coos Bay, for example, to Warrenton, where it's planned to liquefy that gas under pressure, and then to put it onto ships, which are like vacuum bottles, and then to ship it all over to places like China, where they can burn it and produce methane waste more heat and further pollute the atmosphere. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what's proposed in Coos Bay and in Warrenton, these very, very large terminals, they're significantly larger than the facility that failed in Plymouth. Six times the size or six times the volume of gas would be stored in Warrenton, for instance, as in the tank that failed in Plymouth.
Well, now, they're also planning to put a plant to ship fossil fuels out of Vancouver, Washington.
Exactly. There is no shortage of fossil fuel proposals for the Columbia River at this time. The proposal in Vancouver is for 360,000 barrels of oil, crude oil, per day.
Now, isn't this the crude oil that is notoriously flammable and that comes out of North Dakota and some of it all as far away as Alberta?
That's right. So the proposal would initially move what they call Bakken oil. So it's from the Bakken Formation in North Dakota and southern Canada, and would come in unit trains of oil. People are already seeing them move down the Columbia River, which is alarming. And the NTSB has specifically highlighted these trains as a risk because Bakken oil is much more volatile than other types of crude oil. It's at the very high end of the spectrum for volatility. There's also concerns that the producers of this oil are leaving much more propane and other gaseous forms in the oil as they ship them, which, again, creates that explosion risk. And that was put on spectacular display and tragic display in Lac-Mégantic, Canada, where a train blew up back in July and killed 47 people.
Well, and there's pipe leakage and explosions all over the United States just on transportation of oil now. And as I understand it, we're going to be shipping more and more coal, particularly low-grade coal, across the United States, up the Columbia River and out through the ports of the Columbia. Is that not so?
Well, again, the proposals are to do that, is to ship massive quantities of coal. Up to, if you put the three proposals on the table together, it's about 100 million tons of coal per year that we'd be shipping out. And if you compare that with what Oregon, for instance, burns right now, which is roughly 3 million tons of coal per year at Boardman, you get a sense for just the enormous scale of what's happening on the Columbia. Bill McKibben, when he was out, he said, you know, your geography is your destiny. And we have an opportunity to make a real change by stopping this expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure on the Columbia. So stopping this big Vancouver oil terminal, stopping the coal terminals, and standing in the way of this expansion of liquefied natural gas exports on the coast in Warrenton and Coos Bay.
Well, aren't they? Isn't Pacific Power planning to build a coal, I mean, a gas-fired plant right at the entrance to the gorge here near Portland?
Yeah, there's a proposal in Troutdale for a very large natural gas-fired power plant.
So, in light of this UN climate change report just released, the implications go far beyond the impacts here in and around Portland. I mean, huge explosions at a gas plant are one thing and are to be studiously avoided. But if this infrastructure continues to be enhanced, if we continue to build more of these port facilities and pipelines and various transport infrastructure, we're throwing more and more stones on this enormous pile that is threatening to choke us all to death. I mean, this viewed in this light, resistance to these sorts of activities becomes a moral imperative on behalf of everyone, everywhere.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, you can choose to view these projects on any scale you'd like. You can look at the local impacts of something like an LNG terminal in Warrenton, where evacuating 2 to 3 miles would not only be most of Warrenton, it would extend into Astoria. And it's simply beyond the capacity of the local emergency responders. Or you can look at the regional impact of, you know, what we're doing to this estuary that is critical for salmon returning and salmon recovery. Or you can look at the global level, which is maybe the most alarming picture of all, given, you know, what was reported by the IPCC and the worsening effects of climate change. So I think whatever level moves you to act, and we see people at all scales and taking all sorts of actions on this. It's really important for folks to get engaged.
Well, Daniel, I'm gonna let you go. I really appreciate it. Daniel Sarris with the Columbia River Keepers. I think this is a major issue. What I'm trying to do today is to draw attention to the small and foolish things that take place in Portland, Oregon, affecting property values and attractiveness of neighborhoods, and relating that to the larger issues of the transportation of these fuels and to the larger danger, the grand danger of the increase of methane and other poisonous gases, which are greenhouse gases, which heat up the environment. Dan, thanks.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
All right. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio
program. I'm depressed.
Program. You're always depressed.
No, I am. I am always depressed, and I'm always right, and I hate it.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe you've got some calls.
503-231-8187 is the number to call to participate on this program. Pam, good morning.
Good morning. Abe, you kind of touched on this a minute ago. I've been wondering for a long time, how do we put ethics or morality, I don't know, maybe there's a difference between the two, back into the equation that corporations and individuals make especially corporations and our government, for that matter. You know, Obama and or Obama and his buddies up there.
That's really the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or many, many millions of dollars.
Is there some way to sell morality or ethics?
Is there a price or value on it? Come now.
No. Well, I don't know. What by sell, I mean get it into the culture, into our thought. And I'm going to take your answers off the
okay.
air.
Okay. Thank you. That's a very
Thank
good
you.
Question.
Bye-bye.
What do you do? The problem is, as I mentioned before, that the only significant pocket of resistance to the overwhelming body of evidence that humans are affecting the climate of the Earth exists here in the United States and exists at the very highest levels of political and economic power. And in a stultified constitutional system like ours, yes, stultified, that's a dangerous situation. Because how indeed do you confer upon these people the idea that they need to abandon they need to abandon the practices that have made them wealthy and powerful on behalf of the rest
well,
of us.
Well, they're not going to do that.
What did Upton Sinclair say about something like this? It's very difficult to convince somebody that something is wrong if his paycheck depends on believing
well,
it's
really.
Right.
And look, the Republican Party has hitched its star to climate change denial. And clearly, it has a very good chance of capturing both houses of Congress and nullifying or taking away the marginally effective power of the presidency.
And the problem with this issue, too, and now we've talked on this program in the past about how the differences in ideology between, and I'm speaking very broadly here, between the left and the right in the United States. That conversation about these various differences does not happen on a rational level. These are not typically... things that people discuss reasonably. These have to do with things like tribal identity. So you have people who deny climate change, and there's a lot of very a lot of poor white Republicans in this country who deny climate change because the people on their team tell them to, even though they're going to feel the business end of climate change more than anybody else in this country. They nevertheless line up and they agree with the leaders in their tribe who tell them to go ahead and deny this thing that rationality and science says to be true.
Well, I think it just adds to the whole fictional ideology of New Testament literalism. You know, that the world was created in 6 days.
Indeed.
You know, forget the giganticness of the universes. You know, forget anything about evolution. Forget anything about the nature of our climate. Just believe in a story written or told initially and then written down by people who had no real knowledge of the universe.
Indeed. And that's what I'm saying. It is dogma. It is faith. It is not reason. It is not rationality. And that may very well spell doom for us.
Let's get some more callers and maybe they'll cheer us up. 231-8187.
Michael, good morning.
Hey, Michael.
Good morning.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I'm probably not going to cheer you up.
Oh, no.
Okay. And I don't want to hear you reiterate how carbon dioxide is not actually a greenhouse gas.
Well, that's not what I ever said, Abe.
Okay.
But you
continue,
have a tendency
please.
To jump to a conclusion that I'm saying something that I'm not.
Okay. Don't get defensive. Just tell us what's up.
Okay. I'm a skeptic about this whole climate change thing, and I have a good scientific reason. Well, not scientific, technological reason for that, which is I'm a computer scientist, and I know something about the computer models they base a lot of it on. And it's like when you read something in the newspaper and it's actually something you know about, and they almost always get it wrong, but if you don't know about it, you read it in the newspaper and it sounds authoritative. But here's the point I want to make today. Let's say I agree with your assumption that this is a huge emergency, we got to do something really quick, the house is burning down, et cetera, et cetera. This is all about the carbon dioxide cycle. They say we're pumping too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Well, you know, the carbon dioxide cycle has two pieces. You make carbon dioxide and it goes into the atmosphere, or you pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere like plants do, right? It's
right.
A cycle.
Yes.
Okay? So if we, for reasons of industrial progress, have sped up the emission side of the carbon dioxide cycle, there's two things you can do. You could either slow it back down, which is what you guys are all pushing, or you could speed up the other side of it and pull more of it out of the atmosphere. Now,
I would advocate both.
Well, would you?
Yes.
Well, let's talk about the other side of it. there's a naturally occurring phenomenon where dust storms pick sand up out of, like, the Sahara Desert, and weather goes from west to east, and that dust drops into the Pacific Ocean, and where the dust drops in, you get these big blooms of plankton, because the dust contains iron.
Yeah, you've mentioned this in the past.
I haven't. I'm mentioning it again.
Uh-huh.
So, iron is cheap. You could take mass quantities of iron, put it into bulk carriers like the same ships that carry grain, and dump it somewhere in the ocean. And they've done this experiment a number of times. And what happens is you get this huge bloom of plankton. Plankton build skeletons for themselves out of calcium carbonate, which means they're pulling CO2 out of the ocean. Then they die, and their little skeletons rain down on the ocean floor and form limestone, and you have this completely natural biological means of pulling as much CO2 out of the air as you want to. Now, instead of kind of going on a campaign against Prometheus's gift of fire and saying, we're not going to put carbon dioxide into the air, we're not going to do all these industrial things that are really useful to us, why aren't all of these people who are so concerned about this saying, we need to do a massive round like the Manhattan Project of seeing, will this iron thing work? No, instead what happens is the Haida Indians and the Queen Charlottes, they thought they wanted to experiment in this and see if it would work, and there was a guy that they hired who was going to do an experiment for them. And the whole world, you know, the Canadian government, the environmentalists, everybody came down on them like the wrath of God. How dare you do this experiment? And I think the reason for that is that there's two aspects to environmentalism. Environmentalism is, you know, a set of scientific stuff that people have figured out, but it's also a religious feeling. And the religious feeling aspect of environmentalism will not countenance something like iron fertilization of the ocean for strictly religious reasons. It's not rational.
Okay.
It's just that it doesn't fit with their ideology.
Okay, I hear you talking about iron fertilization of the oceans. I don't know a whole lot about it, and I can't really speak to its efficacy. But I also, in describing this, I'm hearing you propose a solution for drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and fixating it at the bottom of the sea. So isn't that, aren't you sort of conceding the point that global warming is happening, that human activity is impacting the change of the climate, and that something ought to be done? All I hear you really doing is proposing that something different ought to be done than the prevailing consensus.
What I said was, if for the sake of argument, I take your assumption that this is such a huge effing emergency.
Okay, that's fine. And you're proposing this iron fixation idea as a solution. That's fine.
Yeah, okay.
But I don't understand why this leads you to be a skeptic of climate change to begin with. Now, you spoke about...
You spoke about
having some knowledge of the computer models that are used to simulate this sort of thing, and that's fine, but I don't hear you contesting the underlying data or the vast correlation of consensus among the scientific community that this is happening.
Well, I could do that, too. I just chose to do this other thing. As far as the vast consensus, everyone goes around saying 97% of climate scientists say blah,
yes.
blah, blah.
Yes.
And where did that number come from? What's the study? No one ever references some study they took,
the
poll or whatever.
The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, whose report we've been quoting from today, makes that statement as well. These are people who are paid to aggregate this data and produce a report describing it.
Michael, listen for a second. Here's my problem. My personal problem with what you're arguing. I can see that the ice caps are melting. I can see that there are crises in various parts of the country having to do with droughts. I can see that the water system, the system of rains and cold and snow and so on, are altering abruptly, much more so than they have in recent recorded time. Now, when I see all those things happening, and I have a reasonable set of hypotheses that confirm that this has to do with a change in climate, I'm inclined, because of the principle that says if you think there's a danger, the thing to do is to limit the danger rather than to wait and see if there's maybe not a danger. I can't remember the principle, but it's a basic scientific principle.
So to sum up my position here, Michael. I hear you saying you're proposing an alternative means of mitigating this problem that everybody else you claim is rejecting on more or less quasi-religious grounds. And you're saying that you have some problems with the way computers model this thing, but I don't hear you contradicting the underlying data. Really, you're coming across as a guy who says, well, I'm not going to like the Beatles because everybody else likes the Beatles. Therefore, I'm just not.
Well, in actual fact, who I liked was the Grateful Dead, but that's not
all. Well, that's fine.
Aha! Aha!
That's fine. You're a rational guy, Michael. You're a scientist, so I'm just having a hard time understanding why you aren't listening to science.
Let me speak to what Joe said, because maybe that will help. Joe says he sees it warming, right?
No, what I said is I'm not even arguing about warming, which in fact is happening. What I'm arguing about is the well, I'm arguing that we have all the signs of warming, the physical, visible physical signs.
Okay, but do you know, for instance, that during the medieval warm period, when industrial CO2 was not happening because mm-hmm. it was in medieval, it was warmer then than it is now. Greenland got its name because it was green, because the Vikings were colonizing it.
Michael, here's the problem with that argument, and it's really a serious problem. Whether or not, in fact, and I happen to agree with the science evidence that I am arguing for, but whether or not that is correct, if climate change is happening, if the globe is warming, then anything that continues to create that warming is, whether, you know, particularly man-made stuff, is stupid. You're looking at a situation where there are needs for remediation, and to argue that, well, natural things have happened that are bad and have produced bad things, therefore you don't need to do something about these things, It logically doesn't make any sense. If there are ways for human society to mitigate against bad climate change, why not utilize all of them? I mean, it has to do with a simple logic of, you know, why not? And also, I would add, there's a lot of money to be made if the world of money making turned its attention to this problem.
Well, if you're making an argument that we should take control of the climate, I might be willing to go along with that, but the medieval warm period was followed by something called the Little Ice Age.
The Little Ice Age, yes.
And we are right now 10,000 years into since the last big ice age, the glaciers. We're 10,000 years into an interglacial period, and they average very closely to 10,000 years. We could also, by putting out CO2, be saving ourselves from the next glaciers. We don't really know any of this stuff, and there is not anywhere near the amount of certainty that the IPCC is putting out.
I'm going to have to disagree with you.
But I appreciate your argument, Michael. I want to give some other people an opportunity.
Thank you. Sure, bye-bye.
Okay.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the AMJO Talk radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. Yeah. Who's next, Steve? Paul, good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
Hey,
so I'm not sure exactly why you gave Michael all that time. I think it could have been dealt with in a little bit shorter time frame, but that's okay. But I guess I wish you guys would be perhaps a little bit better prepared with some of the more detailed when you take on these big issues. Like, be able to rebut some of these things much more concisely. But that's okay. I think we all have a hard time with this. But I want to get back to something that Abe said, which is about the economic downturn, an economic downturn being a bad thing. I'm not sure. Isn't economic activity is what got us into this mess?
Yeah, economic activity is what got us into this mess. But quickly to your first point, that's the problem with hosting a call-in talk radio show. We tend to be a mile wide and an inch deep. We have to be prepared to speak somewhat intelligently on a wide range of subjects. That means that sometimes we sacrifice a certain degree of depth. That's just the nature of the game.
Well, we're getting callers complaining that we're letting Michael have too much time.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Continue, please.
Well, no, the question of economics. So, I think this is a really crucial question. I mean, Michael was talking about like this idea that environmentalism is a new religion. It doesn't seem to have really gained a wide foothold, if so. But I think economism certainly has become a new religion.
Oh, certainly. Oh, so it certainly has. The sort of
why do you say that economic downturn is necessarily a bad thing?
I say it's a bad thing because, all right, the point you're making is a decline in the output of the industrial world. Isn't that a good thing in terms of the climate? Well, from one perspective, it is, yes. However, the way human beings tend to react in response to a downturn in the economy is usually the most negative consequences of that fall on the backs of those who are least prepared to deal with it.
I think there's another factor here that is not being paid attention to, which is the growth of food. If you have large changes in the climate, particularly in lands that are marginally supportive of growing crops, like much of California, or the Salal in Africa, or many parts of China and parts of India, and those places become either flooded out or dried out, and the food cannot be provided, then the cost of food, first of all, the first phase is the cost of food goes up, which means poor people suffer. But the second part of that is there simply is not enough food. Mm-hmm. That creates a situation where people have to move from one place to another. We know that when Lake Baikal dried up to a large extent way back when, Turkic peoples moved across Europe, across to Europe. There was an enormous disruption in societies. It was a lot of warfare, a lot of unpleasantness. And this is what we might be looking at, but in the context of modern warfare, in the context of AK-47s, in the context of explosive devices that were unimaginable at that time, and potentially in the context of nuclear war. So this is really, it's a destabilizer in a world that already, I think, is on the edge of disaster because of warfare.
Isn't it on the edge of disaster because of the economic activity, the way that we have organized ourselves economically?
Yes, yes. And here's how that works. I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, go ahead and finish your thought, and I'll dig into that when you're done.
Well, then Joe said that we can make money off of, solutions to climate change. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the whole model. And then, Abe, you're talking about, somehow white Republicans being the thing, and then there's this tribal division. It seems like I find that somewhat offensive to begin with, calling them tribes, whatever. I think that's somewhat ethnocentric. So I think that there's a general agreement. I mean, is there any questioning on any party's sake of the actual economic model that we're based upon commercial activity, that we're turning the entire world into commercial activity? Isn't that the basis of what's going on?
You mean, is there anybody in a position of power actually questioning the efficacy of capitalism as an economic model? No, there is not.
And I don't know about the word efficacy, but certainly that's the model that dominates the world today. We see it in China. We see it in India. We see it, we see it a lot of places. And I think actually I'm not sure you're arguing with us. I think you're pointing out that the issues really have to do with power relations.
Yeah. Well, listen, actually, I have to admit that I'm actually going to be doing talk radio tomorrow. So I should let other people say something.
Okay.
Hey, thank you for the call. Bye. Excellent call.
Yeah, well, I'm beginning to think that, and this is a personal observation about just what we do here on the station and turning inward with it. A lot of times we get a lot of calls that have either nothing to do with the thing we're talking about,
yes,
actually, or present very, very minority positions.
Yes.
And I think that it serves the interest of the public to hear those.
Yeah.
But we need to probably be setting more limits on that.
Yeah, that's difficult, though, because the ethos of KABU says, let people say what they want to say, and we're not going to get in their way.
I don't think we
have an
answer.
You hear that, listeners? We're on to you now.
Okay.
We're not going to let you off the
reservation
anymore.
Let's hear some more people.
Oh, wait, I got to make a point here.
What? Go ahead.
Okay. So the last caller mentioned, isn't it our very industrial paradigm that got us into this mess? The answer to that is absolutely true. And we were talking about that in the context of food production. And I want to touch briefly on this because it's very, very important in the context of this larger discussion, mm-hmm, about climate change. Right now, The mess we're in is largely due to the fact that in the mid-1800s, we shifted over to an industrial mode of production. I'm not going to go very deep into that change, but it is one of the most profound changes to the basis of human civilization that we have ever encountered. It changed absolutely everything, including the way we raise food. Right now, we are the beneficiaries of, and I use that term very loosely, an industrial food system that that has an energy train that goes all the way back to fossil fuels extracted from the Middle East and from other places around the world. Everything you eat comes to your table at some point along the way, and there are a few exceptions to this, because of the use of fossil fuels.
Now, why I have so much gas?
Could be. Now, here's why I say that. Early in the industrial age, some chemists figured out the magic formula in terms of fertilizing foods. Nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are the big three elements that boost crop production. The problem was that it's hard to get your hands on nitrogen. Nitrogen is an element that likes to bond with other stuff. It's very hard to isolate it and use it in a way that's useful for growing crops. But the use of fossil fuels in an industrial context suddenly made that affordable on a massive scale. So now we're able to use fossil fuel energy to process nitrogen, to make chemical fertilizer, to grow more and more and more crops. And this is what fueled the massive population explosion that accompanied the Industrial Revolution. That's where we are now. The fact of life in the world at this moment is that there are too many people in the world to be sustained by traditional organic farming processes. If we were to suddenly switch away from industrial food production, we would see people die by the millions across the globe. This is a big, big problem, and it's something we have to deal with.
I'm not sure that it couldn't be addressed, though, by a systematic approach. And I also think that...
An incremental approach, certainly.
Yeah.
But cold turkey means you're talking about things like acceptable losses, and that's not acceptable to me.
Okay, let's get some more of our callers.
Gordon, good morning.
Good morning. So much talk. Yeah, we're in a quagmire of crap, really. We've created it all ourselves, and we're going to end it all ourselves. If you look at the article came out of NASA, we got about 15 years left, and we're all dead, so it doesn't give.
Well, I don't think we're all dead. I think we're all in trouble. Some of us are dead. One of the ironies of all this is that the poorest people on the planet, the most marginal in terms of survival, are the people who are immediately going to suffer. And those of us who are higher up in the economic system may have some impact in the near future, but will certainly have impact in the far future.
Well, here's a local impact right now. Trees. Trees are important. Water is important. Ron Wyden is ready to gut our last of our old growth timber with a bill in the House right now. So he's writing this up to start cutting down old growth. And so we need to deal with that. But you know what? Coal, natural gas, water, all this stuff, these are all issues that are really serious. And these people that deny the climate change, all they have to do is go to Netflix and watch Chasing Water. They're going to give an explanation of what's actually happening and how far we've gone over the edge to where we cannot stop anything until it stops itself, because the glaciers are melting at like mammoth sizes. I mean, you have the sizes of ice, the size of Manhattan, breaking off the glaciers like daily. So this is huge. But I think the worst problem of them all, and Abe, you're going to kick my ass about this, geoengineering. It has to stop. It has to stop now. This is the single most important issue in our life, because the geoengineering is melting and destroying atmosphere, ozone. It's manipulating the weather. It's drying out countries. It's raining on other countries. Geoengineering is the worst problem of our life now.
Okay, you got to forgive our ignorance, but you got to explain, what do you mean by geoengineering?
Geoengineering, the manipulation of the weather, the drying up of the weather over Iran, the drying up of the weather over North Korea. They haven't had rain in years. They've had droughts for years. Iran's been yelling about it. They have HAARP, H-A-A-R-P. They have 30 stations all over the country. They're sending electrical pulses up into the illuminated with aluminum oxide. They're sending electrical pulses.
Oh, this is the atmosphere.
Okay. Okay. I can't really speak to this or kick your ass over it because I really don't know anything about it. But thank you very much for the call.
No, I think we're going to have to address this. Last week, when I was just inviting women to call, I had another caller, a woman, who said that the contrails of jet aircraft, which is simply condensation consequent to passing through the higher atmosphere, where the water is. Stable in the stuff, but turns into ice when something passes through it. That all is actually part of a vast campaign to keep the world from becoming too warm. I mean, we have, I think, and I don't want to diss people too harshly, but I think the reality is that these explanations are somewhat of magical thinking.
I agree. You can point to contrails, or you can point to the alleged manipulation of the weather as possible explanations for all this. But it seems to me, Occam's razor tells us, that it's centuries of global industrial economic activity that are creating these problems.
Yeah, and I really think Occam's razor is important. The whole concept of looking for a solution that is most likely, most reasonable, and explains the most of what's going on is a better approach than to find obscure explanations that are pleasing to the mind.
Indeed.
So anyway, I do think, and I want to be clear about this, that we have a crisis in climate. And I do think that human activity is a part of that crisis. And I don't think it matters whether or not there are cycles, vast cycles in the weather system that make for change, if we make the change worse, because making the change worse is real.
Yes. Nobody is denying that there's been a cyclical pattern in the Earth's history of colder and warmer periods. Nobody's denying that. What we're saying is human activity is forcing a very rapid change,
an unprecedented and
exponentially more rapid change than anything we've seen since perhaps that huge asteroid hit during the age of the dinosaurs. The consequences of this are legion, and the UN report that we're talking about points them out in graphic detail. This is a problem not only for human civilization as we know it, but for biodiversity and the ecosystem as we know it. This is a big problem, and it demands an immediate response. And frankly, it is irresponsible, dumb, and immoral for anybody to deny that this is going on.
Okay, let's hear some more callers. 231-8187. We're talking about climate change here.
Who's up, Steve? Okay, well, we'll get to our callers in just a moment. But as I was saying, this is a huge problem. The only place that the people are denying this is in the places where it matters most, in Congress and in boardrooms.
Well, and it's interesting. I'm not sure where the tipping point comes for capital itself, where the selfish, self-centered notions meet the fact that these people have children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and where they suddenly realize that for them, even though they're well off, that there may be some crises here that could have a lasting effect on their lives.
You know, I don't think that realization is going to come. And you alluded to this a few minutes ago. The huge injustice of this all is that the very people who are doing the most to cause this problem probably stand the best chance of surviving it because they have the resources to effectively insulate themselves from the worst of all of this. And they probably are telling themselves, well, that's just natural selection. We are the best. Therefore, we will not be killed by this disaster we unleashed on everyone else.
Let's quickly go to some of our callers. Harvey?
Harvey.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. Well, you know, you're absolutely right. There's over a billion cars doing two rush hours a day around the planet, never mind the buses and trucks and everything else. There's all the planes in the sky, all the ships in the ocean, all the construction machinery, the farming machinery, all the military use of oil.
All the power plants.
And on top of that, you have thousands of utilities pumping out CO2, so it's absolutely right. I have an idea, though, that I'd like to give to you to slow things down a little bit. You know, when people buy electric cars, really they're, you know, the ideal situation is you have solar electric rooftop, and then you plug your car into the sun. But many, many people, like in New York, don't have rooftops. And my idea is to, like in a sunny place like California, they can place ads solar companies can place ads in cities like New York and Chicago that don't get a lot of sun, and or that people don't are in their own apartments or renting houses and they can't put solar panels up, and they can say, you can buy solar panels and put it on our leased rooftops in California. We're going to lease rooftops on warehouses, well, and you can put it there, and you can put as many solar panels as you want that'll equal out, cancel out your carbon footprint and help pay for your electric car bill.
I think it's an interesting idea. Here's the problem. We don't have, in this country, and I don't believe we have anywhere in the world, an adequate transmission system that can move electricity effectively from one part of the country to the other. We have a very antiquated system. It's more like an early 20th century system than the system that we need. And the Congress of the United States and the private enterprise of the United States have not seen fit to develop those systems. And time is against the happening of that.
Actually, the way it works is that the electricity is sold locally by to the local utility, and the money is returned to the person who bought the solar panels of the money they've generated, and that would cancel out their own electric bill. And also, by using less carbon to generate all that sunlight, they're canceling out their carbon footprint. It's a way for electric car owners to plug into a solar rooftop that isn't theirs.
Well, I think the one factor that may support your idea in a different way is the fact that solar panels will become more normative as this crisis enlarges. But let's get some more callers on. And I thank you for the idea.
Thank you very much.
231-8187.
Who's up, Steve? Leslie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is for Michael. There's a positive feedback system going on in the oceans right now. Temperatures in the ocean are rising. When water rises, it holds more gas. When you expose heated water to elevated levels of carbon dioxide, what you get is carbonic acid. The oceans are becoming more acidified. So as the oceans become more acidified, they are less able to support life like plankton.
That's a very good point.
It's like putting goldfish in a pot of boiling water and then dumping in goldfish food. It's not going to make a difference. And we know that carbon dioxide levels are rising because they've studied ice cores extracted from the Arctic that go back, predating the Holocene, predating human life.
Yes.
And it demonstrates that we are at the highest levels of carbon dioxide in hundreds of thousands, probably millions of years. This is demonstrated. This is scientific fact that we are at these carbon dioxide levels. So maybe his area of specialization might be computer science, but nah. In terms of what's going on with the earth sciences, with life sciences, that doesn't cut it. You can't just dump crap in the ocean.
Yeah, that seems like a red herring.
Radioactive trash and oil slick, and you've heated it, and then think, oh, life is going to bloom. It doesn't work that way.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I really appreciate the call. I'm really glad you'd made the call, and I think we're going to have to set some time limits on callers. This is not a criticism of you, but others. And I think that I tend to get interested kind of morbidly in the arguments that contradict what I truly believe. So I appreciate the call, okay? And it's good to hear.
There's a whole show in that one statement.
It's good to hear some rational conversation on this subject. But let's be clear: you cut the trees locally, you hurt the environment. You hurt the price of property. You blow up natural gas, you hurt the environment, you hurt the world. You use up fuels, and move fuels around, you're hurting the planet. You have global warming, you're destroying lives potentially in enormous numbers. We want to thank you. We urge you to stay tuned to KBOO. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, and we'll be coming at you next week.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Thursday, April 10th, KBOO is hosting a screening of the 1998 electronic music documentary, Modulations. The film starts at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Following the film, there will be an after-party across the street at Dots with a live set from Audio Electronic and music provided by DJ Tronic. That's Thursday, April 10th, 7 p.m. screening of Modulations at the Clinton Street Theater.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from X-Ray.fm. The people at X-Ray.fm would like to thank KBOO for 45 years of work in the service of better community radio for Portland and the world. X-Ray.fm is proud to support the pioneering work of KBOO and wouldn't be here without it. And by Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, Rahul Mahajan and Snehal Shingavi discuss the rise of the Hindu right in India. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, more on the police killing of a homeless man in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Also, we'll feature a Flashpoints mini-documentary on the recent San Francisco police killing of 28-year-old Latino Buddhist Alejandro Nieto. At 11 on Stage and Studio, D-May Roberts features Action Adventure Theater's new serial play in four parts, Sidekicks, a scripted improv comedy about the sidekicks of superheroes. We'll also hear from AAT's Pat Moran and writer Emily Gregory. We'll also hear about a staged reading of Philip Khan Gotanda's Yankee Dog, You Die. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Tom Richards, the curator/janitor of the Faux Museum in Portland's Old Town. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you are not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on that tip jar. Now let's go to alternative radio.
This has been the wave that the BJP is really riding. They're using Narendra Modi's credentials as the Mussolini of Gujarat, the guy who makes the trains run on times and builds the roads, etc., as a kind of model that they want to export to the rest of the country. And it's proving to be, I think, a pretty dangerous combination of political forces. Now, what has happened over the course of the last 50 years is the mainstreaming of right-wing Hindu politics, such that a guy 10 years ago who was controversially understood as the butcher of Gujarat is now running for prime minister, and people are bending over backwards to, you know, sort of whitewash his record and his complicity in what is happening. And that, I think, bespeaks a really sort of dangerous moment in Indian history.
That's Snehal Shingavi, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Snehal Shingavi and Rahul Mahajan on the rise of the Hindu right in India. A constellation of Hindu fundamentalist organizations are threatening to shatter the image India has projected of being a secular state. The Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, is the political expression of Hindutva, right-wing Hindu nationalist ideology. It is poised to be the dominant party in what is often called the world's largest democracy. The man likely to be India's next prime minister is Narendra Modi. As chief minister of the state of Gujarat, he was in office in 2002 when there was a notorious massacre of Muslims. Modi has denied any responsibility. Washington was not convinced of his innocence, and when he attempted to visit the U.S. in 2005, his visa request was turned down. But things may be changing with the political winds. Nancy Powell, the U.S. ambassador to India, recently met with Modi, indicating a shift in Washington's policy. Our guests today are Rahul Mahajan and Snehal Shingavi. Rahul Mahajan, a doctoral candidate in sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is the author of The New Crusade and Full Spectrum Dominance. Snehal Shingavi is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He won the Mellon Fellowship in Humanistic Studies and has published articles in various journals, including International Socialist Review. They spoke at the University of Texas at Austin. We begin with Snehal Shingavi.
I think two or three immediate reasons why a conversation like this is important, probably most recently, has been Penguin's decision to pull all the copies of Wendy Doniger's book, The Hindus and Alternative Histories, from its shelves and pulp all the available copies that they had of it because they were afraid of a lawsuit from a far-right Hindu organization, which argued that the book, and particularly the cover of the book, which makes one wonder whether they read the book at all or not, was offensive to Hindus, which has started now, I think, an increasing conversation inside of India about whether or not free speech and the free expression of ideas is actually tolerated, or if concerns about hurt religious sentiment mobilized opportunistically by the Hindu right will always predominate in the political discourse. The second reason, I think, to have a conversation like this that's important is, of course, the fact that Narendra Modi, the architect in many ways of the horrific violence that took place in Gujarat several years ago, in the aftermath of the riots, helped to really sort of clean up the city and make sure that no serious charges were placed against the police officers who were complicit in the rioting or any of the right-wing organizations, which we know played a very strong hand in the promotion of that violence in Ahmedabad, is running for prime minister. And the third reason is that atrocities that took place, you know, the sort of communal violence that took place in Ahmedabad still goes to this day unresolved. There were just recently sort of judicial, whitewashings of Modi's crimes. He was given a clean sheet on the question of his involvement in Ahmedabad too. I think the horror of many, many activists inside of India. So those are just the three immediate reasons for thinking about a question like this. And I think that in terms of our engagement with it, we should be mindful of trying to understand exactly what is taking place in India and, of course, United States foreign policy relations with that country. Now, the last thing that I want to say about this, and this is where kind of current geopolitics are very important. The United States has long held to a strategy of regional control in the Middle East and South Asia, which relied on a kind of trinity of foreign policy interests between the United States, Israel, and India, in which joint military exercises and exchanges of intelligence were going to be the way that the United States conducted its war against terrorism. This, of course, was a contradictory strategy because they also relied heavily on Pakistan being a frontline state against Afghanistan to help in the war on terror. But the ideal trinity was supposed to be India, Israel, and the United States, all of which were mobilizing domestic kinds of Islamophobia at the same time as they were marshaling, you know, their own imperial visions for the reorganization of South and Southwest Asia. So that's my way of trying to situate this conversation. I'll tell you a little bit about myself biographically, which I think may also bear on this. As a kid growing up in Houston, Texas, my father would often take me to Saturday VHP shakhas. The VHP is the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, or the sort of cultural wing of what's called, you know, the Sangh Parivar, the family of organizations which comprise the Hindu right. The Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, or the National Volunteer Corps, and the Bharatiya Janata Party,